In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship except the one true God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and servant of God. I greet you, our viewers, with my usual greeting. This is the universal greeting of peace, a greeting that has been used by all the prophets from Abraham through to Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon them all. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 24th program in our series dealing with the social system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of family life in Islam, and we're touching on a new topic today, and that is Islam's view of sex. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
I wonder if I could ask you just to explain the connection between this program with the previous segments that we've had in this series dealing with the family in Islam.
Okay. Well, the title of the whole series is the social system in Islam. And the premise we had in the very beginning, after covering some of the broader issues like human brotherhood, is that the family is the cornerstone of society, of the social system in Islam. And we said further that the cornerstone of the family is the woman, because of her crucial role in establishing the and keeping the integrity of the family. And that's why I think it was the last 13 programs were totally devoted to the question of position of women in Islam and a comparative type of study. But we haven't really touched on the actual family life in Islam, the questions of engagement, marriage, and marital life, and so on. So as we get closer to that particular interesting and perhaps very practical area in the family structure in Islam, I think talking about Islam's attitude towards sex would be a more befitting topic, and trying to explain Islam's view of sex within the general framework of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, could we get you to perhaps explain for us what this general framework is, so that we may be able to perhaps get a better understanding of just what Islam's position is?
Well, to start with, there are a number of givens or assumptions that we start from. First of all is that sex, after all, is something that relates to human behavior. And behavior in Islam is something which is not divorced from belief, understanding, and the basic frame of mind that the person has. A person, for example, who believes in God, who understands why he or she was created on earth, what mission they have to fulfill, a person who understands that his life will end on earth, that he will die, and then he will be resurrected in the day of judgment and be accountable for his or her life, definitely will behave in such a way that will be totally different from someone who does not believe in God, does not believe that there is any resurrection or life after death, does not believe in accountability, punishment, or reward. By the same token, there are some people who might be wavering between both of these types of positions. And in each case, one's behavior is definitely tied with his ultimate belief in his destiny. The second thing is that when you talk also about sex or behavior in general, and you're talking about improvement or reform in society, logically, the first step towards that reform is to correct the beliefs, is to correct the understanding or frame of mind from which such kind of behavior emanates. That would be the first step, to explain to an individual, to make him understand about God, about the universe, about life, and about human nature. And when we touch on human nature, a basic frame of reference that the Muslim would immediately consider is that a human being is composed of spiritual element, an intellectual element, and a physical, earthly element. A human being has aspiration to satisfy all of these needs pertaining to all of these three basic components. And, for example, Islam provides the satisfaction of the spiritual need through the remembrance and belief in God, through love of God, through various acts of worship. Satisfaction of the intellectual need by encouraging the human to understand the universe, to ponder about creation, try to understand the law of God in nature and in human life. And in the meantime, Islam also provides for the satisfaction of even physical needs. Of course, one of those crucial needs in the human are food and sex. So it's regarded as a natural part of the totality of human existence here on earth. And as such, for the Muslim, the satisfaction of material need, whether they are relating to food or sex, are regarded as part of his life on earth, nothing that is contradictory to spirituality or faith. But the main point, of course, is that Islam insists, on the other hand, that the satisfaction of these needs, human instincts, should be within the basic guidelines guided by the teaching of God in order to ascertain that these needs will be satisfied in a pure, wholesome manner without falling into any extreme.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could ask you to give us a few examples from the Quran and from the prophetic traditions which would help us to appreciate what constitutes the foundation of this this framework that you've been
the basis of what has been
yes
stated.
Okay.
Well, first of all, the Quran indicates in numerous places, in dozens of verses. I'll only give one example. For example, in chapter 18, verse 107, that whenever the Quran speaks about faith and belief, it speaks about faith and good deeds. So it's always tied together. That proves the first point mentioned, that there's no distinction between behavior and the belief and understanding out of which this behavior may emanate. On the question of the human nature and the three basic components, the Quran in numerous places indicates that God breathed into the creation and to the humankind of his spirit. So each one of us has the spirit of God within him. You find that, for example, in chapter 15, verse 29. You find it in the 32nd and 38th chapters in the Quran. In terms of the intellectual component of the human, we find reference to that in terms of intellect to the second chapter in the Quran, verse 31 and 16, 78. Where, again, it indicates that God created not only our senses, but also our intellect, our ability as humans to understand and to reason. That's another component. But equally, the Quran also speaks about the human being as a material existence. For example, in chapter 6, verse 2, and chapter 38, verse 71, they all also deal with the fact that a human is created from clay, a symbol of the same elements in clay, and also a symbol of earthly and carnal desires or need, whether it's for food or sex. On the issue that was mentioned earlier, that Islam is not against the legitimate and wholesome satisfaction of human needs, we find that there is an interesting and perhaps a key verse in the Quran in the third chapter called Ali Imran in verse 14. And it reads in the translation, the verse that says زُيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ حُبُّ الشَّهَوَاتِ, it says fair in the eyes of men is the love of things they covet. Women, of course the equivalent for women would be men, and children heaped up hoards of gold and silver, horses branded for blood and excellence, and wealth of castle and well-tilted land. See, first of all, the first part of the verse speaks about things that humans are created to love. You know, sex, food, property, wealth, and so on. And, but it goes on, without condemning that, it simply says, such are the possessions of this world's life, but in nearness to God is the best of goals to turn to. Then it goes on, the following verse, say, shall I give you glad tidings of things far better than those? For the righteous are gardens in nearness to their Lord, with rivers flowing beneath. Therein is their eternal home, with companions pure and holy, and the good pleasure of God, for in God's sight are all his servants. In other words, while the Quran acknowledges the human need or desire for all of these things, it does not condemn any of them, whether it's the need for sex or food. It simply says that one should not be overoccupied with these things because they are vanishing things. So while encouraging the individual to inculcate his or her personal relationship with God, it does not condemn human needs, nor does it regard it as something that is not clean or pure in itself. There are numerous verses in the Quran similar to that. In chapter 6, for example, when it talks about eating and drinking, but without excesses, without exuberance. In chapter 28 in the Quran, particularly verse 77, it says, do not forget your share in this life. So if one should keep the hereafter in his sight, he should not also deprive himself or herself from the legitimate, wholesome, and clean satisfaction of this. It's obvious from this Quranic foundation, if you will, that there is nothing wrong Islamically in the human instincts in themselves. Nothing is dirty or unclean in itself. But the error and the uncleanness could be in the immoral pursuit of the satisfaction of those needs, or using means which are not lawful and not moral from the Islamic standpoint.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be helpful to some of our viewers if we could ask you just to give us some indication of what Islam views as being excesses or going perhaps beyond the acceptable limits in matters of sex.
Well, if we look at that not only from the point of view of Islamic teaching, but even when you look into history, you'll find that there have been two basic extremes with different combinations in between. Well, there have been the trend, for example, or extreme of regarding sex as something which is not clean in itself, something which is contrary to goodness, faith in God, or spirituality, and in fact something that should be suppressed and resisted in order for the person to be purified. We find implication of this view in terms of monasticism and celibacy, or at least, to say the least, getting married, but to consider marriage and sex as inevitable evil rather than a blessing of God, as Islam explains.
Something you should do if you must.
That's right. If you have to, but if you can avoid it, it's better. This has been one extreme in a variety of degrees. The other extreme, however, seems to have been the one that has been more predominant in human history, and again in different degrees: looseness and the pursuit of pleasure, sexual or otherwise, regardless of the morality of it, in such a way that sometimes may cause harm in the long and or short term to the society, and even to the individual himself who is involved because of the preoccupation with that. And in fact, both of these trends are manifested quite clearly in history. In fact, we find that there is a whole literature written even by saints about demonological beliefs. Even saints themselves, people who were celibate, had visions or dreams of female demons or male demons, depending on the sex of the saint, having a sexual relationship with them in their sleep, and regarding that as something really that's demonical. This approach towards sex results only in hang-ups, in a sort of psychological attitude and struggle within, internal struggle, inner struggle within oneself about the needs and the pressure to satisfy those needs, and the feeling that it's they are bad in themselves. But the other extreme also has been the looseness we find in human history, instances of widespread adultery, fornication, preoccupation with sex, and even sex trade, you know, using sex itself as a source of multi-billion dollar type of business in some form or the other. Well, both of these extremes seem to overlook and ignore certain aspects about human nature, the nature which does have the desires and the need to satisfy those instincts, but again in some moderation and within the moral framework, of course, that religion provides. On the other hand, they neglect also that the success of the individual, the integrity of family and society, can never be achieved if the individual possesses unrestricted freedom to do what he or she desires to do, especially in matters of sex. While sex could be perhaps sublimated or subject to sublimation and different kinds of expressions, it is still a very potent and very strong urge. Indeed, some people have been saying recently, even non-Muslims, that the danger of sexual energy is just as devastating as the dangers of nuclear energy. And both of them, unless controlled and directed and used, harnessed, not suppressed, harnessed in ways which are beneficial to mankind, they could be quite devastating. Using the same military terminology, a person who goes to any large city or small city for that matter is constantly under sexual shelling, you know, bombardment in all surroundings that keeps constant stimulation and even encouragement of the satisfaction of that need, regardless of the morality of it or regardless of, as to whether this is the appropriate avenue or channel for such type of satisfaction, leading in many cases to very serious consequences for society.
Could you perhaps give us some examples of such consequences?
Well, of course, even from the point of view of non-Muslims, social reformers who look into the situation as it exists in our generation, I think there are lots of indications that there are excesses in the matter of sex, there's no question about that, resulting in harm to the health of the individual, to the character of the individual and his ability to be patient and to persevere, particularly people who might be involved in struggle or battlefield. A person who's so involved in sex would not be a good defender of his faith or his country. In fact, many scholars relate the over-occupation with sex as one of the main reasons for military defeats, and there are lots of examples in history. Another harm, which is even more devastating, is that it destroys the characters, the moral character of the individual. Because when sex is satisfied regardless of the mode or the way or channel, of necessity, it would lead to an attitude of selfishness, opportunism, just get what you can, wherever you can, and whatever. And the lack of feeling of responsibility by satisfying sex only as a need without the responsibility of family and responsibility for possible results of the sexual satisfaction. The attitude of lying and deception, again, when one seeks extramarital type of relationship, leading again to some internal conflict, inner conflict within the individual himself or herself because of what is done. In some cases, it might lead to drug addiction, theft, and in some cases, rape and murder. Not only does it affect the individual, society itself suffers. The family, if sex is left loose, the stability and integrity of the family would suffer a great deal. Families would break down, leading to lots of problems that affect not only the family but society at large. And in society, again, we have seen that crimes and excesses and the presence in society, in the case of loose moral standards about sex, of a group of people who only live on that, become professional people who or Sikh. Illicit sex as a profession in some direct or indirect ways, which is, after all, a degrading thing for a human being to be involved into. This is only like an outline. In fact, you know, as you know, books are written about the serious consequences of loose sexual morality in any given society, past, present, or even future.
I wonder if perhaps we could ask you to give us some indication of how Islam attempts to solve the problems of sex while at the same time avoiding the dangers that that you mentioned earlier in the program.
Islam attacks the problem on many different levels, which may include the individual, the family, and society at large. As far as the individual, the crucial thing is to upbring the individual in such a way that he would have in his own heart, inculcate in his heart, the fear of God, or to be more accurate, to be that conscious person. That's called taqwa in Arabic expression. This kind of that consciousness in the individual make him or her able to stand up and persevere in the face of any possible temptation, especially in the face of such a strong and very powerful urge like the sexual need. Another thing is to upbring the individual also with proper intellect, with the proper understanding. You get the faith in the heart and you get also understanding in his own mind by understanding the teachings of Islam in that respect, by taking Islam as God's revelation and use it as the criterion to judge between what is right and what is wrong, what is true and what is false. And as such, a person would not get confused, because we find many people who are trying to convert things and present it to us in a different light. Sometimes vice is presented as a good thing, as something that's justifiable, and many times virtue is being again presented as something which is not good and rigid or backward and all this kind of description. So the intellectual understanding also would be essential for the person not to be confused. And then the other thing also is that Islam provides, in a, if you want more specific areas, is that it prohibits in no uncertain terms the satisfaction of the sexual urge in any form outside of the marital relationship. Only through marriage can this be regarded as a wholesome and acceptable and even sanctioned and encouraged type of satisfaction. Which means that not only does Islam prohibit adultery and fornication, it also prohibits anything that would likely lead to this kind of consequences. Islam stands very clearly against homosexuality and any other perversion, and regard that as something that justifies not only the anger and displeasure of God, but also possibly even in the penal law in this life here. In other words, all the things that many people speak about today as natural are severely condemned in Islamic teaching. Whether you talk about premarital sex relations, extramarital sex relations, postmarital, all these are regarded as aberrations that are absolutely unacceptable from the Islamic standpoint. But in return for this strictness in terms of the morality of the way or avenue for satisfaction of sexual urge, we find that Islam also established a very healthy attitude towards sex. Let me give you some examples besides the verses cited earlier to go to the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. One time a group of people met and they started talking about how to develop their own spirituality. So some of them said, all right, you know, how could we really be like the Prophet, Prophet Muhammad? After all, God promised to forgive all his sins, he's going to paradise, but we should work harder. So one of them said, all right, I'll pray all night and never sleep. The second person said, I'll fast all days, never, you know, miss any day of fast, constant. And the third person said, all right, and I'll also sacrifice all my sexual needs, I'll not get married at all. Apparently, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, knew of their discussion. And then he came to them and said, are you the people who said so and so? They said, yes. He said, listen, I am the most pious of you. I am the most fearful of God of you. And I always remember God. However, I pray for some time and then I sleep, get some rest. I fast sometime, but also I break my fast. And I do also get married. And whoever deviates from my way, he is not of me. To show them that this is not something that he would encourage. So there is no hang up about this matter. In another, this was narrated, by the way, in Bukhari. In another saying narrated in At-Tabarani, he said that if a person is able enough and has sufficient finances to get married, and he refuses or delay his marriage, again, he is not of me. He doesn't follow my path. In another saying narrated in Al-Bayhaqi, he says, whoever gets married, he has achieved half of his faith, or completed half of his faith or deen. Let him be Allah conscious in the remaining half. In another hadith narrated in At-Tirmidhi, he said there are three types of people who deserve the help of God: the one who struggle in the path of God, a person who seeks his freedom, and thirdly, a person who wants to get married in order to maintain and protect his chastity. Indeed, in some cases, even he raised the satisfaction of sexual instinct in the wholesome way to the matter, to a matter which deserves the reward from God. In fact, one time he said that if one of you goes to his wife to have intimate relationship, he will have a reward from that, reward from God. They said, how come we enjoy it and get reward? They said, well, if the person does not get that enjoyment through the wholesome marriage, mm-hmm. in the halal, permissible and lawful, wouldn't he do it in the wrong and wicked way? They said, yes, then it's all right. He gets punishment if he does it wrong, if he does it wrong, and then he gets reward also if he does it right. In addition to this, we find that even the way or the method of approaching the satisfaction, there are lots of prophetic traditions. I can only give a general reference to that in a program like this, that it should not be just a matter of selfishness or physical act, but something that is surrounded with tenderness, understanding, and mutual concern for the feeling and desire of the other party. There are several hadiths or saying of the Prophet, peace be upon him, I'll just give one, narrated in Ad-Daylami, in Musnad al-Firdaus. It says, one of you should not just go to his wife like an animal go to another, but there must be some messenger between them. They asked, what kind of messenger, O Prophet of God? He said, the kiss, the tender kiss, and the pleasurable type of talk and entertainment before the going beyond that. In addition to this, Islam also required the maintenance of the secrecy and the privacy of a marital relationship. There are several hadith in Muslim, Abu Dawood and Ahmad, prohibiting very strongly people from revealing any private thing that goes on between husband and wife. And finally, for young people even, as narrated by Abdullah ibn Umar, he said that if you people, you youth, any one of you is able to sponsor a family or support a family and get married, let him get married. For those who are not able, they should practice fasting. It is a protection for them. That was narrated both in Bukhari and Muslim, which means that fasting teaches the person to have self-control. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of more explicit explanations also. But I hope I get the broad framework within which the satisfaction of sexual urge is regarded as wholesome and noble in the sight of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's leave that for today. We've run out of time. We want to thank you for being our guest. We'll invite you back next week and we'll continue our discussion. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.